Welcome to Garden DC, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about. Welcome to episode 87 of Garden DC. That is the first episode of season 3. In this episode, we talk with Lou Meyer of the Davy Tree Company all about winter tree care. The plant profile is on ginkgo trees, and in the What's New segment, I talk about winter blooms in my garden and the cool things I saw at the Mid-Atlantic Nursery Trade Show. I want to give a big thank you and shout out to our newest listener supporter, David Brunton. David, thank you, and thank you to all of our listener supporters who help make Garden DC happen. This week on the Garden DC podcast, I'm joined by Lou Meyer. He is an arborist with the Davy Tree Company. Welcome, Lou.
Hey, Kathy. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. So we're following each other on Twitter and talking back and forth, but we haven't had a chance to talk in person, or at least in recordings land yet.
I know. I was hoping to run into you last week at Mance, but I had to quarantine, so I did not make it over there.
Too bad. Yeah, I did get to go to Mance for at least half a day and run around and try to be on the safe side. And maybe in the What's Happening segment of this podcast, I'll share a little bit about what I saw at Mance and maybe even what Mance is for those who are not familiar with it. But for your conversation with me today, we're going to talk all about winter tree care and how we can take care of those very wonderful additions to our landscape and make sure that they live long lives. And before we dive into that, we want to talk a little bit about you, Lou. On your Twitter profile, you say you're a Maryland resident, but an Ohio native. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, no, I'm a transplant to Maryland via Cincinnati, Ohio, where I'm from. I grew up, had my most of my career was spent in Cincinnati, Ohio, but I ended up marrying my wife, who's from Laurel, Maryland, and we decided about four to five years ago that we wanted to be close to her family. So we moved out to Laurel, Maryland, and now we reside in Ellicott City, Maryland, which is in Howard County, about 30 minutes north of D.C. for folks out of the area.
And in your upbringing in Cincinnati, Ohio, were you a big plant nerd? Were you born with chlorophyll in your veins?
No, I came upon the industry more out of necessity for a job when I was in school. We're not an outdoor family at all. I did Scouts. I did Cub Scouts and about a year of Boy Scouts. But most of my time was spent playing sports as a youth. And when I went to school, I needed a summer job that first summer. I was at Xavier University in Cincinnati. And a friend of my mother's owned a small tree care company. It was, I think, six employees maybe. And he said, "Hey, I need some summer help. Would you like to help out?" I said, "I've never seen a chainsaw in person, but sure, this sounds like fun." And I fell in love with it. I mean, I still remember the first job that we did was removing a spruce up in a northeast suburb of Cincinnati. And that summer, you know, I'd be hanging out with my friends and we'd be talking about what we did that day. And they all were clerking in their father's offices or just working in retail. And I was telling them stories about, you know, these monster oaks that we were messing with and just really fun stuff, big equipment. And I fell in love with the industry. And I did that for a few years with that small tree care company, but there really wasn't much. There wasn't much ability to move up, and there wasn't much learning. I didn't learn species, and at the time I was 19, I didn't really care much to, because I hadn't decided that was going to be my career yet. But I ended up leaving there, bounced around a few other jobs, and I came back to the industry through a small landscape firm in Cincinnati. I went to work for a small landscape design and install firm. And while there, I started to learn my species and took some night courses at Cincinnati State Community College. So I took dendrology and some design courses, Woody's 1, 2. And when that company closed, the owner sold the company and moved out of state, I started looking for my next step. And I ended up at Davy Tree in our commercial services. So Davy has a number of divisions, the commercial landscape divisions where I started. So we were doing snow work because it was January, and then did some mowing and landscape installation, landscape maintenance. And after about a year of that, I moved over to our residential tree care division that does what we think about when we do tree care is pruning, removals, plant health care. And that's where I really started to focus on the industry. I got my arborist certification, started to learn different tree species, the pathogens and pests that affect them, and was in that career path for about 2 years before we moved to Maryland. And when I moved out here, I joined a third division of Davy, the Davy Resource Group. And the Resource Group is a consulting division. And so I was on the Baltimore Gas and Electric account as a utility, consulting utility arborist, I believe is what my title was, basically doing quality control inspections along the power lines. As the trim contractor came through, I would follow behind to make sure that they were getting enough clearance, that they were cleaning up their messes, and I would deal with customers who had questions or concerns. And after doing that for about a year, I went back to the residential tree care division as a sales arborist, and I covered all of Anne Arundel, a part of Howard County, and then my office covered all of the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And after doing that for a few years, I was a sales arborist, and then I became an assistant manager of that office. This past March of 2021, I moved into a regional role with, technically I'm under our corporate division, as a regional business developer. So I cover all of Maryland and DC with commercial properties and clients, whether it be tree or landscape. And I kind of try and connect the dots and find ways that we can utilize different divisions with clients who've already been a part of Davy. So it's been a really fun pathway. I've gotten to explore different divisions within the company. I've gotten to explore different facets of the green industry, different states and different ways that way. You know, along the way, I've picked up certifications and licenses that are useful and fun to have, and everybody loves an arborist. So it's been a good path.
Wow, that's quite an evolution. And you used one $5, or maybe we can call it a $10 word, dendrology. So we're going to define that as the scientific study of trees or woody plants, as opposed to just botany in general.
Right. Yeah. So the big trees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes when you hear the phrase dendrology or the word, you start to think of dentistry.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And you're like, totally different world right there. So one of the things you had mentioned was your certification. And so we can talk a little bit about a homeowner or home gardener who would hire an arborist, what they would probably need to look for as far as certification or licensing. And usually what you would see on a business card would be something like ISA.
Correct. So the International Society of Arboriculture, or the ISA, is our international governing body. Now the TCIA, the Tree Care Institute of America, I'm failing to remember what the acronym stands for, but TCIA and the ISA are both very strong industry organizations. But the ISA is who grants the certified arborist, the arborist certification. And then once you have that, there are specialties that you can get into. For instance, I carry my a utility specialist and a municipal specialist, along with a TRAC, which is a tree risk assessment specialist. So the ISA, though, is to get your certification, you have to have so much time in the industry, which can be substituted with some educational background as well. But you have to have experience, and then you sit for an exam. And it's a pretty intense exam. It's a 200-question exam that covers everything from knots that you would use in the air or on the ground to soil sciences, basic biology, and even some tree law. So it's a in-depth exam. And then you have to maintain continuing education as well to maintain that. Besides the arborist, some states have specific licenses. For instance, in Maryland, you have to hold a Maryland tree expert license. I believe New Jersey and Connecticut also have those. So some states have specific licenses that you must maintain as well.
And I'm glad to hear you mention that continuing education. So you definitely want to ask your arborist about that, whether they're certified and the certification and keeping up that certification.
Yeah, and you can go to the website. The ISA website has a very easy to search tool. So if you're talking to someone who says they're an arborist, you can easily find out if that is true or not. And of course, always be sure that whoever you have working on your property, especially with large trees, is insured as well. Both liability and workers' compensation are very important for them to carry.
And I can imagine that's one of the biggest expenses of the arborist profession is that insurance.
Yeah, insurance and equipment. We don't run cheap. The insurance is pretty wild. You know, when you're removing a 48-inch black oak from someone's backyard and you're using a 100-ton crane to fly it over their house, Allstate and USAA tend to cringe upon that. So yeah, we carry plenty of coverage in case of accidents. And of course, you know, that's the liability, the workers' compensation. It's a dangerous field when you're working with chainsaws and chippers and trucks and stuff. So you want to be sure that whoever you hire has that insurance coverage in case someone gets hurt on your property.
Mm-hmm. I do remember reading a while ago that an arborist was the number one or two most dangerous profession in the United States.
Yeah, we're usually up there with commercial fishermen or fisher people. It can be dangerous, yeah. But it can be very honorable too. Trees are wonderful things and we love working with them and, you know, being able to work outdoors and hugging trees all the time. It's a great field.
And for defining the different types of arborist, you talked about part of your career, you were a consulting arborist versus one that would say be out there for maintenance. Can you talk about the differences in those?
Sure. Yeah. You know, a lot of times people, when they think arborist, they think of someone hanging in a tree with a chainsaw tied to their leg. I was never a climber. I'm scared of heights. I've been up one or two maple trees about 20 feet off the ground, said thanks, but no thanks. Every year we have to do aerial rescue, so I have to go into a bucket and they fly me around, and I shudder at the thought for 9 months ahead of time. But that's one way. But yeah, consulting arborists. So the RCA, the Registered Consulting Arborist, is part of ASCA, which is the American Society of Consulting Arborists, if we're talking organizations now. So consulting arborists do just that. Everything from mediation. You know, I have a tree on my property. My neighbor hates it. They want to cut down because they think it's dangerous. I don't think it's dangerous. You would bring in a consulting arborist who charges hourly for that. They will go to court frequently. They are, what do they call them? They are witnesses. They know the laws, is what I'm trying to say. So, yeah, it's not just the folks in the trees. A lot of landscapers hold their arborist certification. Again, even though they're not climbing, they know a lot about trees. Arboriculture has to do with pruning trees and removing trees, but it has to do with a lot of things. Everything from soil science, like we talked about, to biology, nursery trades people will have barber certifications. Educators, if you know, there's a whole world of outdoor education to hold your certification that way is great. Municipal arborists, so there's the folks that work for cities and counties and townships. And again, they're probably not going to be the ones cutting the trees, but they're managing that work. We have a whole division that does software development. And a lot of those folks have their certifications as well because they are developing software to manage workloads in the tree care industry. So yeah, it's definitely a very broad field that people tend to focus on one aspect of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think most homeowners, you would want to start with that consulting arborist appointment to talk about your trees, as opposed to, say, a landscaper or a maintenance crew who has an arborist license who would come in and do the actual cutting work or pruning or that sort of thing.
Right, yeah. You know, so when you call a tree care company like Davey or any of our competitors, you know, we'll send out an arborist, and they should be a certified arborist if you're talking to a professional tree care company. And that person can instruct you on, you know, what they see. So when I was a residential arborist, I would go to your house and you'd say, oh, well, I have a question about my maple in front. Okay, well, here's what's going on with the maple. And while I'm here, why don't we take a look at the other trees? And that's not to drive up business. It's a diagnostic thing. When you go to the doctor and you say, hey, I have a sore throat, they're going to take your blood pressure because that's part of diagnosing is making sure that everything is okay on the property, much like a doctor makes sure that everything is okay in your body. So, you know, I might see your oak tree in the back is affected with hypoxylon canker, which is a fungal disease. And I'm going to mention that. So an arborist is going to take a look at your entire property, or should take a look at your entire property and make sure that there are no hazards, that things are properly maintained, and offer suggestions. And then, of course, yeah, they're going to come back with a proposal as well to do the work.
And since we're speaking in the middle of winter time and looking at our tree care for now and throughout the year, is winter the best time to bring in a consulting arborist when the leaves are off the trees, or does it matter?
Yeah, there's two schools of thought. A, it doesn't matter. But some people say that summertime is the best. Some people say that wintertime is the best. I think there are benefits to both. And since it's winter, I'll highlight why it's a good time in the winter. Without a full canopy of without a full canopy of leaves, it's really easy to see the crown of the tree. And, you know, one of the questions that I get asked a lot this time of year is, how can you tell the health of a tree if the leaves aren't up there? Well, we're looking for specific things in the crown, such as buds and, you know, that for the leaves that are going to be coming out next year. And when you're trained in a field, you can see things differently than other people because you know what to look for. So, you know, when I look at a tree at this time of year, I'm seeing it differently than, say, my wife or my friends would, because this is what I do professionally. So we're looking for buds that are present up in the crown. We're looking for fungal growth on the limbs themselves. And yeah, now's a very good time to see that if you're up in the tree. So, you know, if a climber is hired, if a tree company is hired to do a crown clean of a tree, right, to get it up to speed, it's really easy for the arborist to look around and see all those dead limbs up in the crown, as opposed to when it's completely leafed out, because that will hide certain things. So yeah, no, winter's a good time. It's less dramatic of a change for the tree, especially if you're doing some heavy pruning. So say you have a co-dominant stem oak tree, right? So there's two trunks. It splits. Let's say that the oak tree is a 16-inch pin oak in your front yard, so it's a teenager. And it has two trunks that begin 8 feet off the ground. Well, you're going to want to eventually choose one or the other to be the dominant stem. And now's a great time to do that because it doesn't produce as much stress on the tree. So there are benefits right now. You're as a gardener, if you have a full perennial bed underneath your tree, you know, doing work in June and July, or May, June and July, when your garden is in full bloom, you're going to do a lot of damage dropping limbs onto there. Or at this time of year, you know, you've probably either cut back your perennials or they've gone dormant. So it's going to cause less damage that way. Ideally, the ground is frozen right now, which is less and less the truth every year, but you're doing less damage to your turf and to the soil underneath, less compaction. So now's a very good time of year.
That's a great point, Lou, about the damage to your shrubs or perennial borders from having limbs that are cut off, drop down, or even a ladder stuck in there somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
I know that heart-stopping feeling when you've hired somebody and then you're like, oh, please, not the hellebores. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The worst thing, yeah, when we roll up to a job in June and it's an oak tree that's got a extensive spread of, yeah, hosta and hellebores and you know, all the perennials underneath, and you're thinking, how am I possibly going to drag brush from underneath this tree without just destroying this investment? So, yeah.
And so when you're doing a winter inspection, you had mentioned looking for fungal growths or that sort of thing. Is yeah. that common on all types of hardwood trees or specifically oaks?
Well, it's hopefully it's not common on your property. So, you know, for homeowners, when I say, I'm often asked, you know, what should we be looking out for? And so what I like to do is make it easy. And I start at the crown of the tree and work my way down. So when we're looking up into the crown, which is the canopy where the leaves are and the limbs are, this time of year, it's really easy to see broken branches. So, you know, maybe in the spring of last year, we had a windstorm or, you know, we had a bad windstorm here in July, 4th of July weekend. We got hammered pretty hard in the Mid-Atlantic. And a lot of branches snapped off that were either dead before or just were twisted in the wind. And those might be hidden up in that fully leafed out crown. But at this time of year, you can look up and see those. And so, you know, a homeowner, I'd be looking for broken branches that are hanging or crooked branches that obviously snapped. And then working my way down, looking for wounds in the trunk or in the larger branches, you know, wounds being where they've been either struck by other branches or cankers have opened up. So a canker is a fungal disease, and you'll see an opening, kind of like a canker sore, right, in your mouth. And then any oozing in the trunk. So that could be a sign of borers that are boring into the tree. This time of year, they're not going to be oozing out as much, but you can see the stains still from some of those. So that's the trunk. And then moving down, yeah, fungal growths. Now, some fungus is just going to be around, like on oak trees up on the limbs. You'll see little orange jellies that are fungus. That's just going to be feeding on that decay inside those dead limbs because the fungus is a saprophyte. A saprophyte is an organism that feeds on decay. And so when you see the fruiting body, whether it be a mushroom or a conch or a fungus, that's a good way to see that decay inside the tree. It's really a concern when you see it around the base of the tree, what's called the root crown, where the trunk of the tree meets the roots. Because if there's decay present there, that's the fulcrum. When the wind blows and that crown is moving back and forth, the majority of that pressure is on that root crown. So if decay is present there, if you see fruiting bodies there, that's a big concern. That's a red flag. So that raises our eyebrows immediately. And then finally, any cracked soil. So that would suggest heaving or loose soil. So when the trees blow around, now is a good time because when the ground gets hard and frozen, if it's blowing around to the point where it's lifting the root ball, you're going to see cracks in the soil. And that's a bad sign, especially after this last snowfall that we had last week or the weekend prior. You know, we've seen a lot of trees fail at the base. They've just been snow loaded and you'll see that cracking in the soil first.
So if you're seeing fungus maybe farther out in the tree line, maybe under the limbs, but not directly against the base, that's fine. And it's something we might call a fairy ring or a mushroom ring.
Yeah, that's fine. That's probably the sign of an old stump that's underground, you know, that was there years ago. you know, it'd be if an arborist sees that, they're going to do a double take and maybe check and see what kind of fungus it is. Now, there are hundreds of different types of fungi out there, so not many of us are completely solid on our fungal identification, but the big bad ones, we know enough to say, oh yeah, that's a concern.
And I'm also glad that you mentioned that trees do move in the wind and that there is some give and take. And that's the whole reason why almost that they have that leafed out canopy is they can handle that wind load. And maybe talk a little bit about how that creates resistance to the wind and allows that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Once you get into tree biomechanics, it's an interesting world. So when we look at trees and in the wind, let's say you have a 25 mile per hour wind coming from the southwest, which is usually what's happening here, towards the northeast. You would think that a tree would just lean towards the northeast and stay that way, right? Because there's a prevailing wind pushing it that way. Think of a flagpole. You see the flag whipping in a certain direction. But trees don't do that. When you watch them in a windstorm, they move all around in different directions. And yeah, it's the canopy, it's the leaves that have been, for lack of better words, designed or evolved, I guess is a better way to put it, to offset that wind, to absorb it and push it off in different directions so that it doesn't put just 25 miles per hour of straight pressure on that root crown. And yeah, they are supposed to move around. They are supposed to take that wind load, and they can take a tremendous amount. You know, the cellular growth, the lignins in there are supposed to take that, and they do. So yeah, no, great question. Great point.
And a dead tree will not move in the wind.
Yes. Yes. A dead tree will not move in the wind. Once white rot and brown rot set in, and both of those affect different cells of the tissue of the tree, one of them, I'm trying to remember back to my tree biology here. One of them affects the brittleness of the tree, and one of them affects the elasticity of the tree. But yes, they don't move around.
So in the wintertime especially, we can walk around our landscape and we're looking for that fungus around the base of the trees. Maybe that will be evident in the winter or not. But I think also this is a great time of year to be looking for pest issues as far as maybe voles or rabbits or deer scraping around that bark at the bottom.
Oh, yeah, it is. Real quick, back to the fungus. This time of year, you're not going to see a lot of fruiting bodies in full show, but you can find frequently, you can find the, it almost looks charred, right? It's dried up and brown and blackened. And that's what it is. It's dried up fungal growth. So you will find those sometimes. But yeah, for pests, you're looking for deer damage. So the males right now are rutting. They're trying to get that velvet off their antlers. And yeah, the rabbits and the voles, they love chewing on the root crown of the tree. There's a concentration of sugars in there. So one of the reasons why we don't volcano mulch, right? There's a variety of reasons, but one of them is because those smaller pests will overwinter in that mulch. And if they've got a food source that is present underneath that mulch, and that's the trunk of your tree, then they'll go to town on it and they'll girdle the tree. They'll cut off the nutrient flow. They'll eat right through what's called the cambium, which is the vascular layer of the tree. And that's it. That's the end.
And volcano mulching, since we're talking on a podcast and we can't really show a good photo of that, we should probably describe it a little bit. Yeah. So we don't want mulch that is touching the bark of the tree and maybe even creeping up it, kind of making like a teepee around it.
Right. You want that exposed. So when you mulch, you want to keep that mulch about 3 to 5 inches from the trunk of the tree. And you want to see a nice flare. And what I mean by that is a bell, you know, where the root crown is. You want to be able to see that root crown above the soil line where the trunk meets the root. So it flares out a little bit. And from there, 3 to 5 inches out is where you want that mulch.
So besides pest damage as far as mammals go, in the wintertime, can we also see signs of other types of pest damage, maybe some insect damage?
Yeah, so the borers, the insects that bore into trees, they'll leave exit holes and entry holes. Now, most of the time, those are small enough that you're not going to just see them at a glance, right? So, for instance, one of the ones that we've seen a lot over the past 2 years is the ambrosia beetle. And that's going after oak trees, mainly red oaks, but the white oaks are there too. I've seen them on sugar maples a lot and on beech trees also. And the ambrosia beetle, you can tell, is present because the frass it's pushing out is compacted sawdust, and it looks like spaghetti coming out of the side of the tree. It's a very compacted frass. That you will not be seeing now because they're not active, but the holes are these tiny pinpricks, like if you took a pen and just popped it into the tree. Pine bark borer is the same. It's a very tiny little hole, although the pine at this time of year, you can tell if the crown's dead or browning up. Then you would look for those tiny little pinholes. And then the other big one in the area is the emerald ash borer. I'm guessing most listeners know about that, but it's a borer that goes after the ash trees, and that has a very distinctive D-shaped exit hole. And that one you can see at a glance. That one's pretty big.
Mm-hmm. And so used a vocabulary term, frass, F-R-A-S-S, which is the polite way of saying insect doo-doo, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So it's a fun word to use too.
Yes.
And I was going to say that in our area, we're getting more and more pest issues that we didn't have before. And in the wintertime, would we be able to see the eggs forming of some of those pests and be able to remove them now versus waiting till they hatch in the spring?
Yeah. So the real hot button issue in the Mid-Atlantic right now is the spotted lanternfly. And so your listeners up in Philadelphia especially know about this one. It's present in Maryland. It's here. And the spotted lanternfly, its eggs, it looks like almost a caulk or like bubble gum, if you will, although not bright color like that, that is smooshed up on the tree. You'll find the egg masses everywhere, though. They'll be on metal. They'll be on siding. They'll be everywhere. So, yeah, you can see those egg masses, and now's a good time to destroy them.
Hmm. Oh, I didn't know that they were on non-tree bark, that you might see them on like the side of your shed or somewhere else.
Yeah, so there's a big quarantine right now all over the Mid-Atlantic, on trucks especially, coming in and out of certain counties. Because what happens is when a vehicle sits for a long time in an area, and a long time could be 5 days, it doesn't have to be like months, the spotted lanternfly, the female will lay her eggs on that. So the wheel wells of an 18-wheeler, the big one is RVs that sit for 8 or 9 months all winter. You know, in fall, you park it in Bucks County, you park your RV. The female spotted lanternfly is plopping egg masses all over the underside of that RV. And then come springtime, you're driving up to Portland, Maine to do your camping, and you're bringing an entire population with you. So, yeah, the spotted lanternfly is moving most rapidly by egg masses being carted all over the territory.
Wow, I never thought of an RV as a disease vector carrying.
Yeah.
But that does make sense because it's something going from one area to the other. So similar to, you hear the alerts about moving firewood from one region to another and the precautions around that.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And so what about sourcing trees? So if you were to purchase a tree, should you only source from inside your region so as not to introduce new pests or diseases?
I mean, ideally that would be great, but it's pretty difficult to do that. There are definitely nurseries in the Mid-Atlantic that grow in the Mid-Atlantic, but a lot of plant material is not. So, yeah, I would buy from trusted sources, at least, that are hopefully vetting their growers and are paying attention to that. Yeah.
And so the other end of the life cycle, besides sourcing trees, is if you have purchased a home with some large old trees, say over 50 to 75 years old, would you have them inspected right away? And what would you say was their average lifespan? Because we're talking usually inside the Beltway, urban areas, or maybe older suburbs where there's a lot of pressure in, right, in their growing zone.
Yeah, no, we recommend an annual inspection of trees. And so, yeah, if you move into a house, get it inspected immediately. And again, companies shouldn't be charging for those inspections. You know, we are glad, from Davey's perspective, we're glad you're calling us out. We want to talk trees with you. As far as lifespans goes, every species is different, Kathy. It's hard to say. You know, what I will say is that in the urban and suburban arena, their lifespan is shortened due to a variety of things, whether it be elevated heat patterns from being in a heat island, to nutrient deficiency because most of the soils have been stripped away and we cart off any organic material that might fall to the ground, whether it be leaves that were blowing away in the fall or tree limbs that fall throughout the year, or even, you know, animals that are dying in the forest. Those things are all recharging the soil and adding the nutrient load back in. But in our suburban and urban environments, we aren't seeing that. Also, the soil is much more compacted in the urban and suburban areas than you would find in forests and rural areas. Now, again, as people walking over it, even pets, you know, the 30-pound dog running back and forth across your yard over years and years and years will compact the soil quite a bit. So, you know, there are trees in urban and suburban areas that are long lived. You know, there are a good number of oak trees in DC that are near, if not over 100 years old. I'm sure there's a few that are more than that. But yeah, they're not as long lived. So they should be inspected annually by an arborist to make sure that they are in the best condition possible.
And one factor that seems to be impacting our old growth trees really heavily in the last few years is the changing weather patterns and climate change.
Yeah, it is. And it's not just hotter, drier summers. It's the wild weather pattern swings that we're having. So, yeah, speaking in the DC area, in 2018, we had record rainfall. In 2019, we had long periods of drought. 2020, the temperatures were all over. I remember January of 2020, riding my bicycle with my kids in the street in my t-shirt. It was 68 degrees or something the third week of January. It was beautiful. And then in May of that year, we had overnight lows in the mid-30s. And trees don't follow the Gregorian calendar. You know, an oak tree doesn't say, well, April 1st, time to leaf out. You know, they follow weather cues. So when it's 70 degrees in January, that oak or beech or maple or whatever you have in your front yard thinks that it's springtime and they start to push out growth. And that takes a tremendous amount of energy. You know, we have calories. Trees have carbohydrates. It takes their carbohydrates to push out those leaves. It takes a lot of energy. And then when it gets zapped a few weeks later because the weather gets cold, as it should be in February, and then it warms up in March, and then it cools back again, and the trees are using all this energy to push out all this growth, and it keeps getting zapped back. When it comes time to fend off those ambrosia beetles or those pine bark beetles or whatever disease is out there, the health system of the tree is depleted. It doesn't have the energy anymore. So those old trees and young trees, all of them, are more susceptible to failure when the weather patterns are erratic, as they have been.
And what would be your advice to, if you planted a new tree, so maybe a 3 to 6 inch caliper, to give it a good start on life so it does hold up to that changing weather patterns, increasing pest pressures?
Yeah, great question. I would recommend plant healthcare right off the start. So, you know, I have two kids myself, and I like to make sure that they eat their peas and carrots. So I would make sure that my trees are getting the same nutrients, obviously not peas and carrots, but the nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and 7 micronutrients that the trees need. So that includes fertilization. You know, what I would start with, Kathy, is proper planting and proper soil preparation. So begin before you even plant the tree of getting nutrients into the soil, breaking up that compacted soil if you're planting in the city or in the suburbs. Like I said, compacted soil is bad. Making sure that oxygen and water can pass through that soil. And then after planting the tree, you know, I would mix in some soil amendments as well so that your foundation is sound. Once the tree is planted, again, 3 or 5 years down the road, if you haven't prepared the soil at that point, you know, what we use is an air tool to break up soil. You can use you can manually do it with a tool. Although at that point, you're possibly damaging the roots, which is why we use an air tool to break up the soil. Proper watering, making sure that the tree gets the water it needs during the time of drought. Proper mulching, you know, mulch is not the enemy. When done correctly, it's very beneficial. And then pruning along the way. 3 to 5 years in, you should be looking at structural pruning, removing any dead branches, removing any crossing branches that, when I say crossing branches, that they're rubbing against each other. The bark of the tree is like our skin, right? It's the protective layer of the tree. So when branches are rubbing against one another, they're rubbing off that protective layer. I would start with all of that.
And you mentioned pruning, and maybe we can describe a little bit about the proper pruning cuts, and that if you go in with nice, clean, sharp pair of pruners or whatever instrument you use for pruning, that it not be a flush cut directly against the bark.
Yeah, so what we cut to is called the branch bark collar or branch bark ridge, some people say. And when you're looking at a tree, when you're looking at where subordinate branch meets a parent branch or a smaller branch meets a larger branch, or where a branch goes back to the trunk, where those meet up, if you look closely, you'll see an elevated ridge. and when you prune, you want that ridge to be present after the cut. You don't want to prune so far out that you've got an eye poker or a stub, we call it, and you don't want to do a flush cut where you're cutting that ridge off. And the reason why, Kathy, is there are cells inside that zone or that area that heal faster and more appropriately, for lack of better words. And when you cut too far out, those cells are not present. And so decay begins to set in or is more likely to set in. And if you make a flush cut, you cut that ridge off, you're removing those cells. So again, decay is more likely and disease is more likely to set in.
Mm-hmm. And the practice of putting some type of dressing over a cut, is that gone with the 1950s and 60s?
It is. Yeah, it's gone. There are some rare instances, for instance, where oak wilt is present and it's not here. We will use if we have to prune an oak during the active season, then we will use a dressing. I believe that's what I'm told. I don't work in oak wilt zone, so I'm not positive, but that's the rare time. There are some studies with specific products that we're looking at that might expedite the healing, but we're definitely not sealing them up anymore. And I do cringe when I see that. I remember when I started with that small company in Cincinnati years and years ago, I remember we did seal up cuts occasionally. That was the early 2000s. I remember filling a cavity with expandable foam once.
Paint wow. It brown.
It was terrible. It was terrible. But we used to do all sorts of crazy stuff. We used to fill them with concrete. That's one thing when we're working in DC and older areas in Baltimore, we have to be real careful when we're cutting down the large trees because they used to pour concrete into cavities and some of these trees healed over. And now you've got this terrible situation that'll just destroy a chainsaw. So you got to be real careful about it.
Yeah, I do see those occasionally walking around. I'll be like, what is that? And then walk up and you're like, oh, that's concrete in the middle of the tree.
Yeah. That's not natural. That's
no,
not right.
That's so funny. So in our last couple of minutes together, I was going to ask you maybe the hardest question of the day, which is you have a small yard, maybe not big enough for a huge oak tree, but maybe you want something substantial, but you have overhead wires maybe nearby. What would be a recommendation for tree choices in that situation?
Sure. Are the overhead wires above you or near you?
I would say near, probably along the, you know, sidewalk or street line.
Of course. Yeah. You know, one of my favorite medium-sized trees is a black gum, the Nissa sylvatica. and that borders on to a larger tree, but they're slow growing. Reason I love the Nissa is it can handle almost any condition. Nissa was a Greek water nymph, so they can grow in standing water. They love water, but they're also drought tolerant. They've got a spectacular fall color. There's very few pests or diseases that affect them, so they're darn tough. I love Kentucky coffee tree. Those get bigger, but those are really unique. You know, one of the things that we talk about, Kathy, is disease susceptible trees, and there really aren't many out there. You know, there's diseases for everything. But one of the interesting things that we look at with urban forestry is species that don't have a lot of global spread. So, for instance, the ash trees were fine until the emerald ash borer is introduced, and it just wiped them all out. So there are a handful of tree species out there that aren't found outside of North America, and we like to look at those too. You know, one that I really love is the musselwood, the ironwood, the American hornbeam. You know, that's got such a unique, hence the name, the unique musselwood, that sinewy, silvery color. And that's a great Maryland native also. Of course, the pawpaw's always a favorite, you know, for that situation. Not a large growing tree, but you can get some fruit off of it.
And I'm glad you mentioned the musselwood or ironwood, because you do see that throughout Rock Creek Park, and you can really see on there what you described about the branch collar. That's a tree where it's really evident that you can go up to and really look at where the branches meet each other or the branches meet the trunk to learn more about the branch collar and where you would cut.
It's a great observation. Yeah.
It's such a beautiful tree. It's like kind of an elephant look to it, but kind of cool silveriness as well.
Yeah, that's a good one.
So where would our listeners be able to find you on social media, and how would they contact Davy Tree?
Sure. Well, I'd start with Davy Tree. So www.davey.com. We have offices all over the Mid-Atlantic, all over North America even. you know, you can find the local offices through our website. Me personally, I'm on Twitter at Tree Guy Louie. That's me.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Lou. Any other advice for home gardeners when they're caring for trees in the wintertime?
No, just be careful. You know, trees are wonderful, spectacular things, and they bring so much value to our landscape and our environment and our cities. But they are big things. They can be very large things. So, you know, stay within your comfort zone. When you find yourself on a ladder with an extension saw above your head, stop immediately. Call the professionals at that point. It's not worth it. You know, that's where we see a lot of mistakes happen, is when folks try and get outside of their comfort zone. And we all do it. I mean, you know, I've done some electrical projects before around the house that I absolutely should not have been doing, and my wife has reminded me of that. But it can go sideways pretty quickly when you're using saws and ladders and you're aloft. So, you know, respect them, love them, and allow someone to guide you as far as the care goes. Most arborists, everyone that I know, we're in this industry because we really like trees, we love trees, and we really like people, and we want them to coexist. So we're happy to guide homeowners to the best solutions for their property. And that's our aim in the industry, and we just want more trees.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Kathy, thanks for featuring me today. I really appreciate it. I'm a big fan of the show, and glad to be here.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Ginkgo plant profile. Ginkgo trees, also known as maidenhair tree, have beautiful fan-shaped leaves that turn a golden yellow in autumn. They drop their foliage en masse in late November to dramatic effect. This is not the only thing these trees drop. If you have a female ginkgo tree, the fruits drop in late summer and are either a gift or a curse, depending on your personal viewpoint. Some people treasure these fruits for the tasty nuts inside them. Others revile the fruits for their vomit-like odor that can linger for days. The trees are hardy to zones 3 through 9 and are a good choice for urban locations as they withstand both street pollution and road salt spray. They are slow-growing and can take 30 or more years to mature. Ginkgo trees prefer to grow in full sun and in well-draining soils. This ancient tree dates back to the Jurassic period and has a growth habit similar to conifers, with its straight central trunk and branches radiating out from it. It is found in fossil records in the Americas, then disappeared here, and was brought back into cultivation from Asia by plant collectors. There are more than 24 ginkgo cultivars listed in Dr. Michael Durr's Manual of Woody Landscape Plants. The Princeton Century and Presidential Gold are both seedless males that are commonly available. Note that male ginkgo cultivars have been known to convert to female trees on rare occasion. Dwarf ginkgo tree cultivars are also available that are suitable for growing in containers. Ginkgo trees can be trained into an espalier form as well. Here are examples from Chanticleer and in the courtyard of the National Bonsai and Penjing Museum of the U.S. National Arboretum. You can read more about ginkgo trees in the October 2017 issue of Washington Gardener magazine. Ginkgo trees, you can grow that.
In the new book, The Urban Garden by Kathy Jentz and Terry Spite, you'll find dozens of inspiring and creative ways to grow flowers, shrubs, vegetables, herbs, and other plants in small spaces and with a limited budget. Whether you want to grow on a balcony, rooftop, front stoop, or a tiny urban patio, turn your growing dreams into reality and build a gorgeous and unique garden that showcases your personal style while still being functional and productive. With the ingenious ideas and resourceful tactics found here, you'll be maximizing yields and beauty from every square inch of your space, while also making a lush outdoor living area you'll crave spending time in. The Urban Garden, 101 Ways to Grow Food and Beauty in the City, comes out this spring. You can pre-order it now at Amazon.com and bookshop.org.
What's new for early 2022? Well, I've been enjoying the few early blooming, winter blooming plants in my garden, including winter jasmine, which has been showing off its little blooms for a couple weeks now, The heaths and heathers I have planted by my back door. Mahonia is about to burst into bloom. I'm not seeing any hellebore flowers yet, but I keep checking. And I have lots of bulb foliage popping up all over, letting me know that soon we'll have snowdrops, crocus, and those early blooming daffodils. In the local gardening world, I visited the Mid-Atlantic Nursery Trade Show last week in Baltimore, also known as MANTS. And at it, I like to check out what's new and coming to a garden center or nursery near you, and that includes Thuja Emerald Squeeze. So this is a compact arborvitae that I'm really excited about. It tops out at 8 feet high and 4 feet wide, making it perfect for a container garden, for a small size or urban garden, either as a hedge or the back of the border or just a specimen plant. So look out for that. Also, I stopped by the booth of Designs for Greener Gardens of Annapolis, Maryland. This was a first-time exhibitor, and they drew lots of attention for their French antique troughs that they had imported, and they will just add so much character and flavor to a garden, so everybody was drooling over these, and they said they'll be getting a new shipment later this year, so check out Designs for Greener Gardens. In the local gardening world of my own, I host the National Seed Swap Day at the last Saturday of January every year, and we normally hold a seed exchange live at Brookside Gardens that same day, and then another one that following Saturday, first Saturday of February, at Green Spring Gardens in Virginia. This year, we've had to make some accommodations for COVID, so we have postponed the Brookside one to February 26th and have had to cancel the Green Spring one. We are going to hold an event on National Seed Swap Day itself, January 29th, online and live. So check out details on that that are going to be posted soon to seedswapday.com. Happy gardening! Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to anchor.fm/gardendc/support. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.com. Thank you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You can find Washington Gardener online at washingtongardener.com, on Twitter at WDCGardener, on Instagram at WDCGardener, and on Facebook.com at Washington Gardener Magazine.